This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's always that argument that no one person or no one company is big enough. But of course it matters. I mean, that's life. You know, if it never mattered, then why get out of bed, you know, or why vote, or why do anything that's about your contribution?
When we think of resiliency, we usually think of a gritty comeback story or a resilient economy. But can a company be resilient too? Considering that of the world's 100 largest economies in terms of revenue, 37 of them are corporations, making companies more resilient begins to make more sense. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Andrew Winston, is a sustainability consultant and author who's working to make big corporations understand that they have just as much of an obligation to the planet and community as they do to their shareholders. We discuss what Winston dubs the big pivot, the need for these large corporations, just like many countries, to use science-based goals to reduce their carbon footprint, embrace renewable energy, and to develop a green strategy that's much more than just window dressing. Joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Winston. He's a strategy consultant who writes books on sustainability, such as Green to Gold and the new book just published, The Big Pivot. Andrew, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, I wanted to dive into a part of the book that's maybe could be a leaping off point for other areas for us to discuss, shareholder versus stakeholder theory. First, explain, what is a stakeholder and what is a shareholder, and why does it matter to somebody who cares about corporate social responsibility?
Wow, so you dove right into the thick of it. I think this is kind of a core issue in, you know, sustainable business or whatever people call it these days. So, you know, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about what pressure companies are under to perform on financial metrics, basically the short-term pressure to hit their earnings or cash targets, and there's been this idea of shareholder primacy, you know, that the shareholder, the people who buy stocks, and that's everybody from you and me buying through an account, you know, online, to the Fidelities and Vanguards that are, you know, humongous owners, to Wall Street banks. I mean, it's a whole range of people that are buying stocks and in theory holding them for value and believe in the company. That what we can come back to in a minute, how much that's changed in the last 10 or 20 years about, you know, what a shareholder really is or what it looks like. A lot of times now it's just a computer. But the difference is that that's one group of people that care what a company does. You know, stakeholders is a much broader group. It's everybody that might care how a company operates. And you know, in my first book, Green to Gold, we had a list of 20, kind of a circle of 20 different stakeholders. And the ones I focus on a lot these days are, you know, your consumers, your business customers, your employees. I mean, that's a really important one, like how people feel about the company they work for, the communities you operate in, the government, you know, government stakeholders around you, and, you know, NGOs, nonprofits that are kind of asking tough questions of companies. And that's a much broader group. But the big question for business is, you know, are they at odds? Is it at odds to try to please a broader group than just your shareholders? And that's a really interesting conversation.
And just to clarify, the shareholder theory from like the Milton Friedmans of the world believe that a company's sole responsibility is to its shareholders and to increase profits as long as it's not breaking any laws, essentially. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely right. And that, I think, that view still holds tremendous currency, especially in the U.S., but it is breaking down quite a bit. But that is definitely how it's been positioned, that the only, you know, I think what Milton Friedman said years and years ago was the only social responsibility of business is business, or something along those lines, that by maximizing profits and by serving customers, you know, providing a product or service, they were doing a social good. They were solving some problem for customers. And that's not totally wrong. I mean, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with saying that a company is serving some need. But there's been a lot of pushback on the fact that that mentality kind of completely ignores these things that companies do and the impacts they have that fall outside of the normal market. And those things are called externalities by economists. And it means that, you know, going way, way back when, you know, when companies started to be industrial 100, 150 years ago, there's pollution. There's a smokestack, you know, quite literally in many cases. And that pollution isn't, you know, often paid for. It has an effect on people. And in modern times, you know, that pollution might be carbon dioxide, and that carbon leads to climate change. And companies don't have to pay for that carbon in most parts of the world, right? So they're not paying for the damage they do. They're also not getting paid for some of the good they do. There are positive externalities, right? They help communities. They provide jobs. They, you know, there's other things they do. So it's, I mean, there's kind of breakdowns in what's valued in business and what should be valued. So that idea that we'll just maximize profits as currently measured, and that will, you know, be the ultimate goal of company and will be good for society, is just, it just doesn't kind of hold water.
And in the preface of your book, The Big Pivot, you mentioned that the largest 200 companies have revenues of over $20 trillion. It's about 29% of global GDP. So looking at 200 companies controlling almost a third of the world's money, in essence, the term stakeholder kind of takes on a new framing.
Right. And again, both good and bad. But I think that this conversation about shareholders versus stakeholders, I think has, I'll say I've evolved on it. And in the book, I talk about this a little bit, that I was probably more in the camp of saying that the problem, or the reason we were having the challenges getting business to move in a more sustainable direction and to operate in a way that lived within the planet's means, that the big challenge was that they're focused on shareholders. I think the big problem is not exactly that it's about shareholders, but that we're so short-term focused. Because there are shareholders, there are investors that care about the longer term, that want companies to do things that build value over time. Those are shareholders that you know, tend to be more in institutional settings, like pension funds at states and you know, kind of larger holders. So it's not really about shareholders is the problem. It's kind of which ones and what's the focus of it. And so if you're, you know, if you're actually building value and you're caring about your stakeholders and pleasing your employees and your customers and your communities, that does build value. That should please shareholders. So the problem we have now is something very different. And I don't know if you've seen, there's a new book out from Michael Lewis, you know, who writes great stuff about the markets and what's happened since the crash. And it's called Flash Boys. And I've been reading it. And it's about high frequency trading and how different the market is, the stock market is, than what it was, you know, even 5, 6, 7 years ago. It is much more computerized. It is much faster. There are, I think, over half the shares on the market are traded within seconds. So there's a whole huge portion of the market that has nothing to do with investing in companies and wanting them to do well. It's just about playing a game. It's become more of a casino. So I think companies need to, you know, kind of divorce themselves more from the pressure of Wall Street, because it's not actually in their own interests. It's not in the interest of the long-term value of the company or their employees or their customers.
That's a great point. I mean, a lot of, we think of shareholders as somebody at a meeting, maybe a rabble rouser or somebody like a T. Boone Pickens who's really moving the price on that stock. But in between those two polars is a lot of bots who are just flash trading, essentially.
Right. And that's changed. That's new. But, you know, the holding periods of stocks, this has happened over decades. It's not just the flash trading. I mean, the amount of time that investors hold stocks has been dropping steadily. And the amount of time that a CEO is in power has been dropping steadily.
And that CEO's downside to failure has been changing quite a bit in the last couple decades as well.
Well, they make so much money now. So, I mean, it's funny. You could argue that CEO, and there was just, I just saw new data, I think today, about CEO pay, and it's higher than ever. So you could argue that they have a lot of leeway. They make so much money, but in a way, the stakes have gotten higher for them. Their incentive pay, their options, it, you know, it's always about performance in a very short term. So the incentives are wrong. And there's been a few CEOs, a very few, that have kind of pushed back on that and said, you know, my job is to build a great company, you know, build great products and give them to customers and, you know, have a business that functions and profits, but is, you know, kind of pursuing greatness, kind of the old goals of companies, not pursuing quarterly earnings, and the money will come. And there's been a few CEOs that have pushed back on Wall Street. In particular, Paul Polman at Unilever about 4 years ago said, I'm not going to talk to Wall Street so much. You know, we're going to report quarterly because that's what we have to do legally, but I'm not going to spend all this time talking to Wall Street analysts, and I'm going to talk to a different cut of investors who want to think longer term. And I think it's worked very, very well for that company.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and strategy consultant in the sustainability field, Andrew Winston. His new book is The Big Pivot. The graphic you have in the introduction to your book, which kind of lays out the thesis for big pivot strategies. It's a little complicated, but I was wondering if you could maybe summarize the paths to building a resilient company, as you call it, vision pivot, partner pivot, and valuation pivot. Can you walk us through that if you will?
I don't. I mean, I think it's not super complicated, really. I mean, I have in the book kind of 10 strategies, and really the 10th one is about building resilience, this idea of being able to take the ups and downs of the world. But there are, you know, kind of particular strategies within that, like ways to make yourself more resilient. But the whole book is about that. And I have the other 9 strategies kind of in 3 big buckets. The first is this idea of a vision pivot, a change in how we see the world. And we've been digging into one key aspect of that, which is about fighting short-termism and thinking longer term. The other aspects are about setting goals differently, the way we set our targets, and we could come back to that in a way that is in keeping with the science of the problems we have, not just the way we tend to do it in companies, which is we figure out what we think we can do or what would be profitable in a very narrow definition, and then we only do that. We kind of can't work that way when it comes to things like carbon or water or some of the pressures we have. And then third in this vision is asking kind of deep heretical questions. You know, I talk about heretical innovation, you know, really challenging the way we operate. So this vision pivot is kind of the core of the book in a lot of ways. And the other 2 big buckets I'll summarize quickly. The valuation pivot is about changing the way we value things in business. And I'm not saying values, like what do we care about? I'm talking about literally putting numbers on things. And that means changing how we make investment decisions, how we use return on investment as a tool in business, how we, if we can, value natural capital, all those inputs coming in from the natural world. And then the third bucket is this idea of a partner pivot, which means collaborating in very new ways with government, you know, acting in a different way with government, not just fighting regulations, but kind of helping shape things like a price on carbon, which we really need, and collaborating with your competitors and with others in your industry, and then even with consumers in new ways and working with them on reducing the impacts of what we all do. So these are kind of the main elements of the big pivot that I think all work together and really change the way business is done.
I want to dive into setting the science-based goals a little bit more, but just to follow up on your point about valuation, valuing natural capital, what does that mean exactly? Can you give us an example?
Sure. It's a really interesting growing area that is very challenging because the natural capital issue, just to define natural capital, means all of the things that the natural world provides to society and to the economy has a value. Things like, well, quite literally, you know, wood we cut down, or food we reap, or metals we mine. I mean, that's like everything. The whole, you know, our whole society relies on nature. It's not some pretty picture. It's the stuff we make everything out of. But there's more subtle things like flood protection. You know, having wetlands on the coast protects from flood surges and storm surges. Having intact forests can cleanse water. It's a much cheaper method than putting, you know, water filtration plants. And so this is something that, you know, certain regions and certain companies have been working on for years. There's a famous story of New York City spending money to protect the Catskills for cleansing the water that New York City needs rather than building a huge filtration plant, saved billions of dollars. That's an example of the value that natural capital provides. And so there's a move in some companies to try to put some numbers on that and say, how much is it worth? How much is it worth to us to have these wetlands here? You know, Dow Chemical has these huge refineries in Texas. They've been working with the Nature Conservancy for years to say, what is the value of this nature that we're relying on? What's the value of the things that help bring us water? You know, what would a gallon of water cost us if we had to pay nature for it? And there's a lot of reasons companies are trying to do this. It's a challenge. It's a new kind of field, but it's expanding and growing. I think companies are getting smarter about how they use the analysis to think about their business and where their risks and opportunities might be.
Now let's turn to the science-based goals. How can a company engage? We often will see the latest IPCC report, but these are much more big picture concerns that a CEO or even a chief sustainability officer from a Fortune 500 company may not even think that they can begin to make a dent in it, but you look at it otherwise.
There's always that argument that not no one person or no one company is big enough. And look, there's some truth to that, you know, on some level. I mean, people have always said to me things like, oh, in my personal life, does it matter what I drive, or does it matter if I use green cleaning products? And I always say, look, there's 7 billion of us. So no, it doesn't matter if you added it all up, but of course it matters. I mean, that's life. You know, if it never mattered, then why get out of bed, you know, or why vote, or why do anything that's about your contribution? And big companies will stay, as big as they are, they will say similar things like, well, what we do doesn't matter. It's a little less true for them. They're really big, as you said at the beginning of the program. So they do have an impact. But yes, any one company, even the biggest one, isn't going to solve this problem. But my point about science-based goals is kind of just very, very practical. Like if you know, I use the metaphor of you're in a boat filling with water with a bunch of survivors of something, and you know what you don't do is ask everybody how much they think they can bail today. You know, you figure out how much you need to, and you divide it up, and that's the pace of change. And that's, you know, that's what needs to happen with carbon. We know how fast now we need to go. There is really good data.
We need to start bailing now and not worry about how much everyone can bail.
We have to go at a certain pace. That's just the science. We have numbers from McKinsey. We have numbers from PricewaterhouseCoopers. PwC has calculated that we need to decarbonize our society, which is the amount of carbon we emit for every dollar of, you know, economy, by 6% a year. And right now we're going at, you know, less than 1% a year in improvement. 6% is a much, much faster pace. And that, to me, is the goal that companies need to set. We all are part of this. And that's the goal that cities, countries, companies, individuals, that's what we need to set. And that leads you down different innovation paths. If you set that kind of pace of change, it leads you to some different discussions. And that's the benefit of it. It's also, there's plenty of analysis showing now that this pace of change is actually very profitable. I mean, what we're talking about is using a lot less energy and moving away from volatilely priced fuels to renewable energy. It will save us money and heartache in many other ways.
What do you mean exactly by the science that companies need to be following?
Well, it depends on the topic. But if we're talking about carbon, I'm talking specifically about the base global scientific consensus from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They've put out their scenarios that says, here's how much we need to reduce carbon if we want to hold the world to 2 degrees warming. That's kind of what the world's governments have agreed is the right target, even though some scientists say that's not even enough. And there's analyses, again, from like PwC and McKinsey, taking those numbers, I mean, that's the science from IPCC, taking those numbers and saying, okay, if this is how much carbon we can emit from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution till the time we stop emitting carbon, to hold the world to 2 degrees of warming, then here's how much we have left to burn. And there's a bunch of companies that have come together recently, big companies, European mainly, but some American, that put out a kind of statement in the last couple of weeks that said they want the world to agree to hold emissions to 1 trillion tons of carbon from the beginning of kind of carbon emissions. And we're moving towards that very fast. So we only have so much time. And, you know, yes, each company will handle how they manage this differently. And actually the goals might mean that some companies need to get bigger, not smaller, if they're in the business of helping others reduce carbon. And so things get complicated. They do. But by and large, the carbon intensity needs to reduce 6% a year. And that's got to be the kind of base goal for every company. And then from there, we can kind of make shifts about, well, which ones really need to change in a different way than that.
And in the back of your book, The Big Pivot, you have an appendix where you give some examples of how companies would use specific science-based goals. Like, for example, Coca-Cola needs to focus on water. So their goal is to replenish 100% of water used by 2020.
And right.
Maybe you can give some other examples.
You know, again, it depends on the problem. Carbon is the one that I'm really talking about mainly on the science base, but there is science around other things like water availability by region. The difference is carbon is global. You reduce carbon anywhere, it has the same effect. Water, you know, for Coke to say they're going to replenish water, they really need to look at it by region, by context, as some call it, context-based metrics or context-based thinking. You know, there are similar scientific, you know, kind of directions or help in other areas, toxic chemicals, toxic, you know, elements. Always very controversial. The science evolves, but, you know, there are a handful of, you know, chemicals in products, in plastics that a bunch of companies have kind of moved towards removing. Walmart has been asking suppliers to get rid of a list of about 10 key chemicals, and that's based on the growing science that says there's harm from these. And so part of this, you know, goal or idea of keeping to science-based goals means companies have to kind of keep abreast of the latest science. You know, years ago, lead was seemed like a great idea to use in products, and then it turned out putting it in paint was really dangerous for us. So there's, you know, having a goal of zero lead in the paint in your house is a good goal. So it depends on the topic, right? You know, each topic is going to have a different kind of framework for thinking about what the science is. I think the carbon is actually kind of the clearest because it is global.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to sustainability consultant Andrew Winston. His new book is The Big Pivot. So what does a resilient company mean to you, Andrew?
Well, I think, you know, resilience in our, you know, picture it first in your own life, you know, in your own health. You know, you're resilient to the ups and downs of life. You're resilient to getting a cold if you're in good shape. You're resilient to you know, getting injured if you've been exercising a lot or you're in, you know, been eating right. You're resilient monetarily if you've got some savings, if you've got, you know, a base to fall back on if something happens, if someone loses a job, if someone gets ill. You know, like a resilient system is one that can handle extreme change, both good and bad, but usually it means, you know, things are hitting you hard. For a company, it's the same thing, you know, and I'm saying, are you resilient to extreme weather? Do you have facilities in multiple places so that when there's flooding in one region, you're ready in another? I have clients who quite literally companies, they've had to move equipment to the second floor in some places because it keeps getting flooded. Cities are talking about resilience, like New York. I mean, the evidence of not being resilient is more clear. Like when we had Hurricane Sandy sweep through New York City, the lower half of Manhattan lost power for 4 days because the grid got wet and a substation exploded. That's not a resilient system, right? So there's talk now about Con Ed, the utility, and the city spending a lot of money to make the city better able to handle the kind of storms that come in. And they call it a resilience plan because that's what it's about. You know, can you take change? And can you potentially even come back stronger? Are you in a position where deep change might be good for you?
In your book, The Big Pivot, you admit that these are mostly prescriptions for larger companies, but a lot of the same lessons apply to small and mid-sized businesses. But this idea of being able to rebound from natural disasters, et cetera, that kind of resiliency seems like where the wheat would get separated from the chaff, where we could get into more corporate inequality, if you will, where a small company doesn't have the means or the capital to have a second refinery somewhere. The giants will continue to be able to rebound from these kind of problems.
It's an interesting point. I mean, no one's ever really kind of asked me that, and I think it's a fair point. You know, if you're small and you have fewer facilities and they're in a place that's, you know, short on water or short or getting hit by storms or, you know, reliant on one particular input, you know, maybe you make apparel and, you know, cotton is your big input, and cotton prices, a couple of years ago, cotton prices went up 300%. That hit everybody in the industry, but certainly if there's someone who that's the only thing they're working with, cotton, and that's the products they make, it's going to hit them harder. And I think that's a fair point. You know, if you look at the towns that were, you know, practically destroyed by Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, you know, any small business there where that's their livelihood, that's it. You know, there's no, if they're the flower shop, they can't just say, well, we've got our other flower shop in this town inland. So, you know, there are going to be painful losses with the volatility we're facing. We're facing, and this is, again, one of the larger reasons we need all companies and all individuals to kind of think really hard about climate change and resources and move as fast as we can so there's less of these problems, so we're not stranding people. There are going to be people hurt by these changes. So this is why we need to fight and kind of avoid them.
Are there some solutions that you see that cross all size companies, for example, renewable energy?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things we've been talking about resilience in this kind of negative way about, you know, kind of rebounding or dealing with pain. But one of the things that makes you resilient, I think, in one pretty serious way, is to be reliant not on, you know, volatilely priced fuels, fossil fuels, and not so much on the grid, but to have a lot of your own energy. And renewable energy is far more available and far cheaper than people realize. And there are companies moving towards renewable energy very quickly. And I think this applies to any size. I have it on my home. So clearly a small business could do it if they had a small facility and had a roof and could put solar up or could share it with businesses in the area. There are an amazing number of ways now to get renewable energy. And most of the companies that are buying like solar are actually doing it in a way where they don't spend any more. People think, oh, renewable energy is too expensive, and it's just really not true anymore. There's a model for buying it where you lease your roof and you just buy power from a company that provides it. You're not buying the solar panels, you're buying the power. You're leasing your roof, you're giving the roof to this company, they put up the power, they put up the solar panels, and you just buy the power like you do now. And you pay the same or less. You know, people don't realize that, you know, Walmart has renewable energy on 1,300 stores now, something like that. They're the biggest solar buyer in the country outside of the military, and they're increasing their solar buying. And IKEA is the kind of most renewable energy focused of all companies. They're going to be about 70% of their energy will be renewables by next year. So there are companies doing this, and again, people don't realize how available it really is now. And that's kind of the kind of upbeat, great message, because there's so many win-wins about this. This helps us get more sustainable. It reduces emissions. It can reduce costs. It makes you more resilient. It is a kind of brilliant solution to so many of our problems.
Strategy consultant and author Andrew Winston, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lettuce, Dr. John, and Neil Young. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org.
check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.